This hour is brought to you by NJ Diet. Visit NJDiet.com or call 855-5-NJ-DIET.
Mike Florio.
Let's bring in Mike Florio here. Joins us on the program.
NBC Sports.
All right, Florio, I know you're probably busy.
Pro Football Talk.
Starts the day, he ends the day with Pro Football Talk. He is Mike Florio.
Within moments, a long national nightmare is apparently coming to an end.
I don't know what you're talking about. You can't trust a quarterback who can't stay healthy.
I wouldn't listen to some of those people out there, especially guys like Mike Florio.
Go to hell with your big brain. Ladies and gentlemen, Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio.
Mike Florio with Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi.
How are you, Mike?
On the Score.
It's just Bernstein today because Layla is out. She'll be back tomorrow. Mike Florio joins us now. He is at Pro Football Talk on Twitter. He's on the Alpamonte Nissan Hotline. Alpamonte Nissan on North Avenue in Melrose Park, or at apnissan.com. What's going on, Mike? How are you?
You know, it's funny. Every time I hear that open and Rich Eisen says, "How are you, Mike?" I almost respond every time. Like, I have that little flash of, do I say something now? Every time.
So, well, you do enough of these. I would imagine you can probably do some of these in your sleep with the amount of time people ask you how you're doing.
And I have.
Yeah, I'm
based
sure.
Based upon the quality.
Well, it's schedule release time, and we draw all sorts of ridiculous conclusions and try to figure things out when we have no idea whose quarterbacks are going to be hurt and when and what the quality of any of these teams. It's a fun exercise, though, to start seeing it shape up. It makes it real when you have an actual schedule.
Are you not a fan of picking the winners of every game in every week of the season all the way through week 18 to know in early January whether or not the Packers are going to beat the Bears? Do you? I mean, I live for that. I don't.
It's
ridiculous.
Think...
It's a ridiculous waste of time, and it will happen tonight on ESPN and NFL Network. They'll be picking games. You're right. Injuries change everything. Teams get better. Teams get worse. It is ridiculous to even pick the week one outcomes in April or May, much less picking the week 18 outcomes, but they'll do it because people like it. And it's one thing to take the Bears schedule and go through, that's a win, that's a loss, that's a win, whatever, to try to do it for the whole league. It's a waste of time, but they do it, so people must be interested.
It must be a valuable waste of time then for people. We talked yesterday about Aaron Rodgers, and I kind of thought this thing through. And you hear teammates and hear everybody talk about their loyalty to him and you know, what a great leader he is. And then I think, you know, does a great leader drag teammates and fans through his own personal issues and use them as proxy shields and leverage devices? Like, I don't know what it says about him. Why, if this is a contract negotiation or if this is just you being unhappy with them drafting a quarterback, have your agent handle this or you handle this. It starts to bother me after a while when his desire to manipulate others as part of whatever process this is.
And then to preserve the ability, Dan, to show up and say, I didn't manipulate anyone. What are you talking about? This is all nothing. Why are you making a big deal about this? This is the media's fault. The media is the enemy of the people. I mean, basically, that's the game that he's going to play. I think he's going to find a way to show up. I think the messages from last week's surrogates, John Kuhn and James Jones, I think that was laying the foundation for him to show up because the Packers aren't budging. They're not going to trade him. So it's play for us or play for no one. Oh, and if you play for no one, you owe us $11.5 million in unearned signing bonus for this year and the $6.8 million roster bonus we paid you earlier this year. We'll take that in the form of a check, please. And if you want to sit, just go ahead and sit. And he's not going to want to sit. He's going to come back. I can't imagine him giving up one of the final years of his career because he wants to play for someone else. I think he'd rather play for the Packers than play for no one, and I think that's where this is heading, and he's going to act like we all made a big deal out of nothing when he shows up.
I think it's probably going to happen. I just think if I'm a teammate, I'd be really tired of it. And it's not my job to cape for you, especially when I heard Devontae Adams yesterday. And when he said, you know, I was playing golf, and then I heard the news about Aaron Rodgers being dissatisfied, it kind of ruined my round of golf. And it's like that, like, why do that to a teammate? Why should a teammate's round of golf be ruined just because you're playing head games with people?
Well, I think about some of the other things that have come out. He reportedly told teammates last year who were due to become free agents, hey, I'm not going to be here next year. He engineered, I believe, I don't care what anyone says, I believe his fingerprints are all over the news dropping when it did hours before the start of the draft, because that was his Michael Corleone type revenge for what they did to him on the first day of the draft a year ago when they traded up and took Jordan Love without telling him, he made sure that his discontent became top story in the NFL entering the draft. And, you know, it potentially rattles the Packers as they're trying to do their work. Brian Gutekunst told Peter King after the draft that they weren't going to let this distract them. Well, how do we know it didn't distract them? And if you're a Packers fan, do you appreciate the fact that your quarterback created a distraction for the Packers that hovered over Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of the draft when they had bigger fish to fry than worrying about this story that engulfed the league? And, you know, having the brain trust fly out there at least three times to California to try to unruffle his feathers when they clearly have better things to do between January and April. There are a bunch of things you can point to if you're a Packers fan and say, dude, what are you doing? What are you doing? We understand it. We get it. You want out. You don't have to create these issues, these distractions, these hurdles that are aimed at trying to make the team not as good as it could be, frankly. And if I was a Packers fan, look, I'd be mad at the team for making this mess via the drafting of Jordan Love, but I would also be mad at Aaron Rodgers for letting this mess become a distraction and intentionally making it a distraction. It's one thing if it just kind of happens. He intentionally made it a distraction for the Packers.
We're doing what we do anytime Tim Tebow's name is available. We talk about it because we sort of feel compelled to, I guess. And I'm trying to figure out how they talked through the decision to bring him in, if indeed they talked it through, like what the end game is that ends up being a positive for the Jaguars. Is this something as simple as Urban Meyer just like his reaching out to his football son and just saying, yeah, we got nothing to lose. Come on in. You want to try your hand at tight end? Because we know Tebow is just blessed with this ongoing privilege to kind of do whatever he wants in sports just because he's allowed to be a dilettante. But what is really the benefit to them as an organization to do this?
Well, it's funny, back when he retired from baseball, a career that never quite was able to be nudged all the way to the show, even though the Mets understood the potential financial windfall of doing so, I joked that he'll end up in Jacksonville as someone on the staff. Just find a job for Tim Tebow. That's what he's going to do. I never would have dreamed that they'd find a way to justify putting him on the roster, but this is nepotism / cronyism applied to a 90-man roster. And people have said to me, how dare you deny this man his dream? Hey, folks, you got plenty of other guys out there who have a dream to be on a 90-man roster, who have a dream to try to become an NFL player, who play tight end and have played tight end and have more tight end skills than Tim Tebow will ever have. Give one of the jobs to them. This is Meyer, number one, firmly in charge of the organization. Number two, behaving like he did when he was a college coach, and no one is going to question me and no one is going to doubt me. And good luck selling that to the locker room when they're giving you the side eye when you're trying to convince them that Tim Tebow has great ball skills. The one snap he had at tight end, he had anything but great ball skills. The pass hit him in the head. And so, this is about, and I think one of the reasons why they haven't done it yet, got to figure out what we're going to do with Gardner Minshew, because we need number 15. We got a clear Minshew off the roster. We got to trade him. We got to cut him. We got to do whatever because we need 15. We need to put 15 on the back of these jerseys, Tebow on top of the nameplate, and let's sell as many of them as we can. And it'll be interesting to see how many Tebow jerseys they sell in comparison to Trevor Lawrence jerseys, because I think that's what this is about. The Jaguars have fully embraced the entertainment value of what football is, and they are going for maximum attendance, maximum relevance, maximum money. And they'll hope that, you know, they actually win some football games along the way.
It's just amazing how long it's been since Tebow mania and all that storm of stupidity. And just if you're a young player in the Jacksonville Jaguars locker room, how many of those guys have any clue what that all was at University of Florida and what all the ensuing concurrent mysticism was and everything? Like, people are going to need an explainer. Like, who is this guy? What is this guy doing? Why do we have a 34-year-old guy learning this position? Why is he getting reps? Like, genuinely, it's been a long time since he even mattered at all.
You wonder how many of these guys, though, the young guys, you know, you take 10 years off the clock, they're 11, 12, 13 years old when Tebow mania hit. How many of them were fully aware of it? How many of them were smitten by it? How many of them are going to be... I don't know what the attitude is going to be by other players toward Tim Tebow, but I think that you know, they understand, number one, he was never a very good quarterback. He just found a way to pull the rabbit out of the hat often if the game was close in the fourth quarter. For whatever reason, he reached a level of performance that he didn't reach in the first three quarters of the game and that he never reached in practice. He was an abysmal practice player. But, you know, it was a great run, and it overwhelmed the Broncos. You know, the Broncos have never experienced anything like it. Even with Peyton Manning, Von Miller, they've never had anything like Tim Tebow and the attention he brought. And, Dan, I remember being at the media center in Indianapolis for the Super Bowl they played there, and it was the day that Tebow made the rounds with his entourage. People were brushing past Joe Montana to follow the Pied Piper, who is Tim Tebow. That's how big it was.
That's just
like, get out of the way, old man. Get out of the way. Coming through. Look out. Tebow's over there. That's exactly – I witnessed it. I couldn't believe it. Brushing past the guy who was the greatest quarterback of all time at the time to get to Tim Tebow.
That's just so dumb on so many levels. It really is. Speaking of you being right on stuff, you mentioned that he'd end up in Jacksonville. You called it on Deshaun Watson, I think, too. Just saying that it, at least with all these civil issues, start cutting checks and at least make them for now. That element of whatever legal concern, you know, criminal stuff be damned, at least he can make that stuff go away. It sounds like that's what's going on. I don't know if it's unlimited resources. I don't know how this can maybe facilitate a potential trade and what the stomach of a trade partner is going to be for this. But it does look like there's some actual movement in the story.
Well, yeah, because there's been silence for nearly 3 weeks after the lawyers had been going at each other every chance they could get, social media posts, statements released by the two camps, press conferences. The last time they were in court, the Friday before the draft, the lawyers were accusing the parties on each side of destroying evidence. After that, it quiet and it stayed quiet. And that tells me that they're trying to work this out. And if they can settle these 22 cases in a way that is acceptable to all the individuals involved, I think someone will trade for Deshaun Watson, even with the very, very strong possibility he gets suspended by the league. You can't not suspend him. After what they did to Ben Roethlisberger with two accusers in 2010, they suspended him 6 games, reduced it to 4. And at one point, I found the language from the letter that Roger Goodell sent to Ben Roethlisberger. And even though the context is somewhat different, you could take a lot of the reasoning that Goodell relied upon to suspend Roethlisberger and apply it to the behavior that Watson admittedly has engaged in. This widespread practice of having massages, and his attorney already has admitted that sometimes they became consensual sexual encounters. I think the NFL will do something about that. And I think that a team like the Dolphins or the Eagles, which I think are the two most likely to make a run at him, they'll be fine with that if they don't have him for 4 or 6 games, because after that, they'll have him for the rest of the year and beyond.
Well, the sword of Damocles then is actual criminal charges, because there are multiple open investigations.
Well, and if you get these cases resolved, then the 22 plaintiffs have gotten their justice. They are no longer motivated to see a grand jury be impaneled. And it was, how are you going to satisfy proof beyond a reasonable doubt when you've got the two people in the room and no objective evidence, no way to break the tie between who's telling the truth? It becomes very, very difficult to get a conviction, and before that, very difficult to convince a prosecutor to go forward with the case. So I think between the possibility of the league's investigation, criminal investigation, those go away if you settle the case, because part of the settlement is these individuals agree to not say anything to anyone about any of this, and that's a legitimate term. You know, there's this negative stigma about non-disclosure agreements. It's part of what you get compensated for when you settle this case. You want me to not say anything? That there's a value. There's a price that you pay, and I agree not to say anything. That's the way that he clears the decks, and he's able to move forward with his life. But for whatever 4-game, 6-game, 8-game suspension the league would eventually impose.
Mike Florio, thank you as always. Look forward to talking again next week.
All right. See you, pal.
That is Mike Florio. Next up, you are going to hear deep baseball thoughts from a deep baseball thinker. He is working for MLB now, trying to fix a broken game. Theo Epstein has ideas next on The Score.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Morning Show.
Mully
and Haw here.
We're with you every morning on your way to work, live at 5.
We've got the day's biggest Chicago sports stories to start your day off right.
Mully and Haw, mornings 5 to 9 on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
And on your device or smart speaker through the Odyssey app.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
We just have to be open-minded. You know, look, we can tweak the playing rules. We can tweak the ball itself. We can look at some of the dimensions on the field. There are a lot of different variables. We're changing the size of the bases in the minor league this year to try to encourage the running game and make the in-play environment a little bit friendlier to hitters. So it's incumbent on us to find out as much as we can about which of these changes work, what variables are most important, so that we can work collaboratively with the players who also have an interest in making the game the most exciting version of the sport, and then, you know, just nudge us towards that very best version of baseball.
Bernstein and Rahimi, middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
All four bigger bases, and after seeing another near collision with Brad Wick in the game yesterday with the Cubs, have the damn safety base on the first base line already. The rest of us, you have the orange base. You can still do all your replays and everything else. Just make it safer in that regard for the guy running down there. It's a dumb way to get hurt. Go with the safety bases already. I've got no problem if you want to make the... And the other rule that has been talked about for a long time that I would be all for... That was Theo Epstein, by the way, on Bill Simmons' podcast. The other rule I'm all for is some sort of breaking the plane regarding contact with the base, or rather than the idea of sliding into home, how difficult it is to actually try to brush the base with your foot or brush the plate with your foot. If you're over it, you are on it. If you break the plane of the perimeter, you don't necessarily have to put downward pressure or have contact with the base. I just think it's the spirit of the rule would make plenty of sense doing that, and revisiting the way we talk about being on the base or having the base in that regard. But he talked about a range of things and sort of how we got to where we are in the game. And one aspect that he pioneered, and he knows he owns some of this. He's been part of the group of intelligent thinkers, always looking for that next advantage and always looking for inefficiencies and trying to find things out, asking what don't we know, and then trying to know more things. That's led to knowing a lot. And what we know now, what we're able to know about what goes on, has helped pitchers more than it's helped hitters. So what do you do about that?
Baseball as an industry has weaponized data and technology for pitchers exponentially better than they've done so for hitters. So yeah. The modern pitcher gets to like train for velocity, then gets a full biomechanical breakdown of his body, of his delivery, the kinesiology of his delivery, how it moves. Then he gets to go into a pitch lab and get recommendations from an analytics staff about like making fine tune adjustments in his grip to get a little bit more spin on his pitches, get a little bit better movement. You can optimize individual pitches. You can optimize attack plans. You can optimize repertoires. And then at the same time, so pitchers just have more going for them. Our understanding is so much greater. And even if it's outside the 30 organizations too, companies like Driveline have just done an unbelievable job at helping pitchers optimize velocity and certain traits that lead to swing and miss. And so they've never had more going for them. And at the same time, there's never been a time in baseball history when less is asked of pitchers than is asked right now. Like if you go back a generation, what was the job of the starting pitcher? It was to get into the eighth inning seventh inning, eighth inning, or finish the game if you could. That was the starting pitcher's responsibility. Now, and there were 10 or 11 pitchers on the staff. And so you had to give your manager innings or your whole team would fruit. And so when you have to prioritize volume and innings, then you have to factor in efficiency and get some early count outs. You have to pace yourself a little bit. You know, you might come out throwing 88 and then you dial it up to 92 or 93 when you need to, or you need to strike out. But pitching was more of an art back then. And now it's more of a science. If you in a lot of places, not for every pitcher and not for every team, not in every instance, but now the job for a lot of starting pitchers is defined not by like, let me hand the ball to the closer or shake the catcher's hand at the end of the game. Now it's, I need to miss as many bats as I can, punch out as many guys as I can. And if the manager has to come get me in the fifth or sixth inning, so be it. I've done my job. There's nine guys behind me who throw 97 in the bullpen. We're going to punch out even more guys.
Right.
So pitchers have more going for them and less is asked of them. And they're just doing a phenomenal job at using the technology and using the data to throw harder, have their breaking stuff also, which is at a greater velocity, move more. And it's fundamentally changed the game. A 25% strikeout rate, which is the league-wide rate right now, is Sandy Koufax and Nolan Ryan's career strikeout rate. So the entire league right now is striking out batters at a rate as if they were Nolan Ryan or Sandy Koufax.
And that's why we see what we see. And it's hard to make baseball entertaining when that's going on. They're too good. It's velocity, it's spin, it's a whole lot of nasty. The pitching is too good. And now they're trying to find ways to do some restrictor plate racing here. You gotta move them back. You got to make it harder for them to do what they're doing, or nobody is going to be interested in what's going on. They talked about a lot of stuff, and one of the things that they discussed that I think you'd really find interesting, and maybe the best chunk here, is he gives us some more insight into what happened in 2016, specifically the now mythical Game 7 rain delay, about what happened in the weight room and Jason Hayward and everything else. And as we've gotten further from it, I think he's gotten a little bit more comfortable sharing some proprietary details about all of it. We certainly know what the aftermath was for him. And boy, I heard stories about what was going on in the front office and elsewhere, and all the nonstop parties that were going on there. But he talked about what happened that night in that moment before the Cubs came back and won the World Series.
We had a great comeback to get to a comfortable lead in Game 7 that slipped away in a hurry with a three-run inning. And
then it just starts raining, just out of nowhere. Yeah. What are the odds of that happening?
It was nuts. I mean, and that probably won us the game. I mean, you give up a home run like that, the stadium was shaking. It was one of those times where, like, you can feel it shaking around you. Our players were stunned. We somehow get through the ninth inning. Chapman still out there. He pitched a ton in that series, and he was going on fumes. He somehow gets through the ninth inning, and it starts to rain. And I remember I had to go meet with Commissioner Manfred and Chris Antonetti of the Indians to figure out, like, what are we going to do? It's never rained in Game 7 of the World Series before. It's getting late. How are we going to handle this? So I took off from behind home plate where I was, cut through our clubhouse to get to this auxiliary room where we were going to have the meeting. And as I cut through the clubhouse, I didn't see any players. Like, typically during a rain delay, when you go through the clubhouse, all your players are at their locker, like taking their wet uniforms off, checking their phones, kind of everyone's at their locker doing their own thing. I didn't see anybody. So I got a little concerned, and then I looked in the weight room, which had just like a little glass part, a peephole sort of on the door. I looked in, and in this small weight room, all 25 players were gathered around. And what happened was Jason Hayward and David Ross and a couple other veterans recognized that we were shaken by what happened, the home run. They called everyone together. Aroldis Chapman was in tears for what had happened in the game, feeling like he had let everyone down. And then one by one, all the key veterans on the team stood up and said, like, this is not going to happen. Like, we're gonna win this for each other. We're gonna win this for you, Chappie. We wouldn't have been here without you. Like, all this hard work, everything we put into this, no one's gonna take this away from us. Like, it's gonna stop raining. We're gonna go out and we're gonna score a run. And then Schwarber, who was leading off the next inning, was sitting there with a bat in his hand, like a raging bull. I couldn't wait to get back out there. It was so emotional. Guys were hugging each other, rallying each other, and then it was, you know, that team was really close. So it's like all those relationships that you build, all those connections that you make from day one of spring training through, you know, 6 weeks in spring training, 6 months of the season, 3.5 weeks of a postseason, you get to this point, and their instinct after getting rattled like that, you said it was, you know, like a death blow, that kind of a home run on the road after having a three-run lead. Instead of having the instinct to go to their lockers and be by themselves and check their phones, they rallied together, picked each other up. 17 minutes later, Schwarber single, Bryant fly ball, moves the pinch runner on more to second base. They walk Rizzo, and Zobrist doubles down the line, and we scored two, and we needed two because they came back and scored one. We hang on by one. So, yeah, it was like absurd, just the odds that it would happen again that way. But I also don't think it was an accident. You know, it was a reflection of the fact that we were one of those teams that had those bonds, that kind of connection where, like, you can come back from a disaster on the road at the biggest moment like that.
You know, I have to tell you that the idea of a rallying cry, win it for Aroldis Chapman, it doesn't exactly sit real well. That it was hard enough to get past the cognitive dissonance of that move and knowing, all right, it's about winning, and you may not necessarily want to root for this guy after what he did, and it's not that easy to do. You'd obviously like to have a little bit easier connection with the people for whom you root. So, boy, it made it a little easier when it was just kind of Jason Hayward rallying the guys than it was them trying to go out there and win one for the chapper. Yeah. I don't know. I can't be the only one that's a little bit conflicted about that now having more meaning in hearing how it came down. He's in tears. Okay, fine. That wasn't my level of any joy or connection to this Cub team was in spite of Aroldis Chapman. And when he becomes even more important to the victory story, I don't know that would be my ideal outcome of an anecdote like that. If you catch my drift. But hey, that's it's a life lesson into how we think about our sports teams and understanding that we have to compartmentalize. So it's just yet the latest reminder of that. But that was Theo Epstein, the former president of baseball operations of the Chicago Cubs, on with Bill Simmons on his podcast. And that has led us up to the midday midway. And you say, well, what do you have today? Well, I learned about a new fish, and it's appropriate. This is like the perfect midday midway story on Sports Radio 670 because it's football fish. There's an actual fish called football fish, and now I know that, and you'll know more about it. And I also have a place where someone should not be hiking, and they probably should have known based on the name of the place that they were hiking. There is a new Twitter feature as well that sounds absolutely awesome, and we may all decide to avail ourselves of it. So all of that coming your way on the Midday Midway next on The Score.
Odyssey is your new home for all the audio that matters to you. That's Odyssey, A-U-D-A-C-Y. Download the Odyssey app today to listen to The Score and Odyssey Station. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, midway.
The midday midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The midday midway with Bernstein and Rahimi. Middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
Time for the Midday Midway. What do we do so far? Well, we talked about last night's crackling Cubs-Cleveland game. We also talked White Sox with Steve Stone and football with Mike Florio before hearing some long-form Theo Epstein stuff from the Bill Simmons podcast. A climber in Utah was rescued Sunday from a mountainous area known as Certain Death after a large rock the size of a refrigerator rolled on top of him, officials said. Rescue crews responded around 4 p.m. to a call of an injured climber in the Gate Buttress area of Little Cottonwood Canyon, part of the Wasatch Cache National Forest, located about 15 miles from Salt Lake City, according to Salt Lake County Sheriff's Search and Rescue. Two climbers had been navigating new routes in a waterfront area above a location called Certain Death when the accident occurred. That's the name of the area. It said one climber had pulled off a large rock the size of a refrigerator that had rolled over the top of him. Two ground teams were sent to reach the climbers, but officials said the difficult terrain and nature of the climber's injuries instead required a helicopter to airlift him off the mountain. The rescue operation lasted about 90 minutes. I know years ago, the Tournament of Bad, Terry's Region, had hiking at the Iranian border. As part of it were the U.S. kids that were caught up in some issues there. I would add to that, hiking in an area called Certain Death. If you can avoid that, maybe it's not so certain for you, but probably hike, I don't know, elsewhere
lack of roster depth.
A beachgoer strolling along Newport Beach, California last week discovered a strange-looking fish that rarely washes ashore. Ben Estes spotted the fish in the sand Friday morning at Crystal Cove State Park and alerted state park rangers and lifeguards about the weird-looking find. And I will say it is that. A picture of this has been posted at Bernstein Rahimi on Twitter, so you can see what we're talking about here. In a Facebook post by Davies Locker Sport Fishing and Whale Watching, a boat tour company that operates in the region, the fish was identified as an 18-inch-long deep-sea Pacific football fish. The Pacific football fish is one of 300 living species of anglerfish normally found at depths of more than 3,000 feet below the surface. So what's interesting is that there are certain fish that live at those depths that when they come up from those depths, they lose structural integrity because they're designed to have the weight of that, or they're evolved to have the design to have the weight of that water all around them, like the blobfish, for example, which ends up, you take it out of the water, it looks like Ted Cruz. But they said the fish itself is not rare, but it's extremely rare to see one this intact along a beach in Southern California. The Pacific football fish has a unique look. It uses bioluminescent lures at the tips of a fishing pole-like projection from its own head to attract prey in the dark, murky depths of the sea. It's not clear where the fish will end up. It's currently in the custody of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and obviously it is deceased. But this is, I mean, you talk about really seeing what an anglerfish does. It has a fishing pole with little things that dangles in front of its mouth that look like dancing lights that could be fish. And the closest thing I would think, did you see the movie Finding Nemo? And there's a scene in which the critical goggles that are worn by the dentist are retrieved by Nemo and Dory, and at one point they have a showdown with a deep sea anglerfish. And it's just sort of in my mind's eye right now. I don't know that it's exactly a Pacific football fish, but I would have to go back and see, or maybe just do an image search for the anglerfish. Yeah, I think that may be it. It's pretty close, although this is sort of a scarier looking version of it, but I think that may be it, if you can picture the one in Finding Nemo that had the goggles on it. How about an ability on Twitter to not just block somebody, but to nuke somebody? It's a nice option to have. I generally will default to a mute, because mute's easy. The person's following you. You just don't want them in the conversation anymore. You're just mute. And block usually means there's something, you know, more, if you're like, you know, following the MyPillow guy or something like that. If you're actively part of something that's just kind of gross or being abusive, obviously. And I like to check every so often to see where I am in mutes and blocks, because this is going to give me something new and fun to work with. I think I'm at like 5,000, like 9,000 mutes and 5,000 blocks or something like that. I don't know what the actual total is. But there's something called Mega Block. And Mega Block is a feature that lets you nuke a tweet. So what it does is, with Mega Block, when you select it, you can block not just the author of a tweet and the person or the poster of a tweet, but you automatically block everyone who liked it. So if there's something you find absolutely despicable, this is a feature provided by a company called Gen Z Mafia. They describe themselves as a community of young builders, and it's called Mega Block. So it blocks the bad tweet, it blocks the author of the tweet, and every single person who likes the tweet. I wonder, I always try to think, like, what would be the risk of doing that? I really don't think there's anything, right? I don't see a potential downside to this other than improving the quality of your Twitter experience.
The downside would be if people are liking it to bookmark it to come back and read later or comment on later, right? Like if it's, that would kind of be the concern, because sometimes that's why I hate the like feature.
I don't.
It should be a bookmark feature instead, or a separate feature altogether.
I've never used like.
I like to save stuff.
If I like something that much, I'll retweet it.
Yeah,
I just don't say, oh, and if you like something I wrote, retweet it, like share it, send it, amplify it. I don't think likes do enough to amplify.
It doesn't seem that way, just because I run several social media accounts, and I don't know if I'm any good at it or not, but retweets are way more effective than likes. So I, with that in mind, most of the time when I'm using a like, it's to save something that I want to visit later instead of like, this was great. Like,
my favorite thing that happens to me is when I will go and see something that I've accidentally liked, because it's almost always on my phone because of the way Twitter scrolls, and I'll try to hit something, and I'll hit something else, and I'll look and I'll have like three tweets that I've liked. And I'm like, wait a second, I don't remember. It's entirely by accident, because I do not use that feature. So you're right. I did not know that people would like something just to mark it, and then all of a sudden you're wondering why you can't get in touch with them. It's because they were part of some sprawling mega block.
I don't really comment on people on Twitter. Oh, those people are idiots.
A lot, yes, indeed, a lot of them are. There are idiots, and there are. I saw somebody. I enjoy it so much. Somebody was sharing that's like Mike Lindell now says he has the best evidence yet that he's got the Dominion voting machines, and he can prove that they're connected to Hugo Chavez, and he's also now direct marketing his pillows to people. Oh, right! What a world! What an unbelievable world we live in. I'm still obsessed with the football fish, because that's really kind of cool. It's bigger than a football, though. That it certainly weighs more, and a football has fewer teeth. But yeah, that's a pretty cool job, anglerfish, because you don't really have to do much.
My question reading the story, Dan, was how does that fish stay fully intact from being that far down? It said most of the time when they recover fish like that, they're like, it's just pieces of the fish, but it's not like fully intact the way they did. I'm curious how that happened.
I don't know, because what happens is when you bring something up for the depths, these fishes are evolved that live down there to expand. Like they need the pressure of all of that heavy water around them to maintain their integrity, and then you bring them up and they sort of cease to be. Do you follow Roman Fedortsov on Twitter?
I do.
He's
not
a fantastic follow. He's a Russian commercial fisherman and photographer, and he goes to sea for weeks on end and posts pictures and videos of their bycatch, of stuff that ends up in their trawler nets, of stuff that they go through, just the strangest things you've ever seen in your life. And he explains what they are. I mean, some terrifying looking creatures that he runs into, but he takes really good pictures of them. And more often than not, it's all, by the time he's got it, it's already almost unrecognizable, like you say, because it's so misshapen. But that's what Twitter's for, is for follows like that, like the Rex Chapman stuff and those videos, and Roman Fedortsov. I think he's just an R. Fedortsov. And it just shows off all sorts of cool things. But when he's on land, he'll share other videos, but then he goes off on these long voyages, these long fishing voyages, and shares things. So that's something to keep in mind if you're looking for somebody to follow. That is the Midday Midway, which we do most days around this time. And we're cut a little short today, but we're going to do an extended segment with our guy Cody Decker, talking about everything that is happening in Major League Baseball right now, looking at some unlikely division leaders, talking Cubs, talking Sox, talking all of it. We always have fun, and just getting him to tell some stories too is always great. So Cody Decker, our Odyssey MLB insider, joins us next on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Here.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.